Good morning, and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning. Glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. Each show is archived on my website at AnneLiguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. Well, the U.S. Women's Open is in full swing this weekend at iconic Pebble Beach. And earlier in the week, I caught up with Steve Eubanks, longtime golf journalist, editor, and LPGA historian, to preview the third women's major on the calendar. And Colin Burns was the general manager of Wingfoot Golf Club in Westchester County for 30 years before becoming COO of the new Apogee Club, an exclusive private facility under construction in Hobe Sound, Florida. Recently, Colin was honored with the Lifetime Achievement Award from Prince Albert of Monaco. You'll hear all about it in my interview with Colin and his favorite memories from helping to run several major championships while at Wingfoot. And Christina Kim, longtime golfer on the LPGA Tour with an exciting career. She won 3 times on the LPGA Tour. She won on the Ladies European Tour and the Symetra Tour. And she was a 3-time Solheim Cup team player as well. She always has a fun and positive approach to the game. Enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. How many of you have played golf at Pebble Beach? If you have, you know it's the most iconic venue. And this week they will be hosting the U.S. Women's Open for the first time. And joining me now to preview the U.S. Women's Open is the most talented and versatile Steve Eubanks, longtime golf journalist, author, editor, and LPGA historian. Welcome, Steve.
And it's good to be with you, as always. It's great seeing you in New Jersey at the KPMG, I am so looking forward to going to Pebble Beach, and I know all the players are as well.
You are one of the LPGA Tour's biggest supporters from a media standpoint, and I love your enthusiasm. You're always there at these LPGA Tour events, and you do some work with the LPGA as a historian. I mean, I just love the fact that you really have supported the women all these years.
Well, it's only because I was given my choice, Ann. You reach a certain stage in life, you get to do what you love and be with the people that you want to be with. And the women on the LPGA, the players, the administrators, everybody involved in this, they're just tremendous people. And I really, really enjoy being out there. You don't have a lot of curmudgeons. You don't have a lot of people who don't love what they're doing. It's not a job for many of them, and it's just a passion and a life, and that's wonderful. That's what I want to be a part of in these waning stages of my career.
I love it. Yes, cherish every moment, and you do such a great job for the women. And talk about Pebble Beach. And every time I think about Pebble Beach, from a personal standpoint, I've had some beautiful days there playing, but the very first time I played it, I think we were the very first tee time, and it was so foggy that, I think for the first 5 holes, you couldn't really see maybe 40 feet in front of you. So you really had to trust the caddy that he could find your ball, and he said, just hit it here. I'm like, I can't see anything. But you must have some personal experiences of your playing Pebble Beach. What would be your most memorable moment?
Well, yeah, when you make the turn to the seventh tee and you kind of everybody gasps, no matter how many photographs you've seen, and it's one of the most photographed par threes in the world, but you cannot appreciate it until you see it, until you stand on that tee and see those cliffs and get the 3D perception of what's in front of you. You just have no idea how much beauty is associated with that entire area. And it's almost difficult to focus on your golf at that point. You're standing there looking at, anywhere from a 90 to 130 yard shot.
Right. Downhill.
That you're not sure. Yeah. That you're not sure you can hit because you're just standing there saying, golly, this is unbelievable. So it's a wonderful way to commune with nature. And I know from talking to a lot of the players who have never been there, they really can't wait to get to experience that as well.
Oh, my gosh. The iconic par 3-7. Jim Nantz got married on that hole, by the way.
Yeah.
And then
built it in his backyard.
Exactly. Built a replica right in his backyard at Pebble Beach. So, yeah, so much U.S. Open history there. 1982, Tom Watson winning. 92, Tom Kite. Of course, Tiger dominating there in 2000. I was there for that in 2000 and for Graham and McDowell's win in 2010. And then in 2019, Gary Woodland. So, you know, it's so great that the women finally have this opportunity, right? And it's not just, you know, at Pebble Beach this year. They have future venues. They have Erin Hills in 2023, Riviera in 2026, Oakmont in 2038, I think it is, Marion. So, you know, finally, the women are in the U.S. Open are getting some amazing, you know, prestigious venues just like the men have, right?
Well, they really are. And I think it's so important for the women to go play these iconic venues where people have memories of the holes and memories of the championships that have been held there in the past. And I will go back to 2 weeks ago when we played at Baltusrol, and people remembered those iconic events that were held there. They remembered Jack Nicklaus winning in 67 and in 1980, Jack coming back, and the one iron that he hit in 67, the standoff with Osio Aoki coming down the stretch in 1980. People remember all of that. And so to then see, you know, Ronnie Yen come in and hit every single fairway and green on the weekend was extraordinary. I mean, to witness the caliber of play that the women have put on in these iconic venues, I think has elevated people's perception of the game and have brought a lot more eyeballs to the women's game. Same is going to be true next week. I can't tell you how many players have told me they have family, in-laws, cousins, everybody coming out to watch them. And I told every one of them, you know, they could watch you play anywhere. They're coming to see Pebble Beach.
They certainly are. And what a great golf course to walk if you're a spectator, too. I mean, just as you say, just nonstop, you know, taking pictures and just kind of cherishing those views. But I know NBC Sports is going to be broadcasting a record 12 hours of coverage on NBC next Saturday and Sunday, including live prime time coverage for the first time in the championship's history. So that's exciting. You'll be able to see it live prime time. And then there are a lot of other, you know, pre-championship coverage begins actually Tuesday, July 4th with Golf Central Live and then Peacock. You can watch it on the USGA has a mobile app, uswomensopen.com. You can see it on Peacock. So there's a lot of ways that if you can't be there in person, you can certainly take it in, which is good.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be, I think that the network has stepped up. I think that the USGA has stepped up. I know Rolex, one of the corporate partners associated with the USGA, has stepped up. Everybody wants this venue and these incredible players to be out here for all the fans to see. And, you know, it's going to be hard to miss.
So Michelle Wee West will be playing. She was on the show a couple weeks ago, and you know she really hasn't been playing much. But her husband Johnny West, who's you know the son of NBA legend Jerry West, he's going to be her caddy. So that should be interesting.
It's going to be fun. It really is going to be fun to see Michelle again. I mean, I don't think from a performance standpoint, a lot of people expect a lot out of Michelle because look, you have to have competitive reps, as we all know, to play well in a championship. But look, she has done so much. I think outside of her playing career, she could be as impactful in the game, maybe more so, than she was inside the ropes. The things that she did at Liberty National and crafting the Mizuho event up there and bringing in the juniors and doing all of the things necessary to make that event really one of the marquee new events that we've ever had. To see the things that she's doing in the various communities. I don't know if you remember seeing those LPGA hoodies that were on sale.
That's right.
For charity. That was Michelle's design and her idea. So all of those things are Michelle's initiatives. And, boy, she's doing some wonderful work.
Yeah, I love to see that. She's so connected to the game and a great mentor to so many of the young players, including Rose Zhang, who was the winner of that Mizuho America's Open at Liberty National in her first professional tournament. And you and I know what a whirlwind it's been for her, Steve. Talk about Rose Zhang and boy, how she's just really maintained such composure for her young age and, you know, just turned pro a couple months ago.
It reminds me a great deal of when Lydia Ko burst onto the scene as a 16 and 17-year-old. You looked at this person and you listened to them and you watched them play and you thought, this isn't a teenager. This is an old soul trapped in a teenager's body. And you get the same impression with Rose. This is someone that has a preternatural maturity for her age, but then goes out and just performs like you can't believe. The shots that she hits under the pressure situations that she's in, the putts that she makes coming down the stretch, rolling in just one, five, six, seven-footer after another, never making a mistake, hitting to the right parts of the greens. These are all things that you do not expect from a 20-year-old. And look, she contended deep into Sunday at the major championship in New Jersey. So, I think everybody's going to be watching Rose Zhang this weekend, and as well they should.
Absolutely. And Annika is going to be playing the U.S. Open. That will be great. Annika Sorenstam, you know, she's been seriously practicing for these now, right? A couple years ago, she wasn't really playing much golf, but she's gotten a lot of attention with this post-retirement career, I think.
Well, Annika, she never wants to show up unprepared. I think when she got the invitation to play at Pine Needles last year, she was unprepared. She had a lot of other commitments going on. As you know, she's the host of one of the LET events in Sweden now. She has her foundation. She has all of her junior events. She and her husband, Mike, have launched a line of beverages, fizzy bees. She's out marketing and promoting that at all times. And I think she was embarrassed. I think she showed up unprepared and was embarrassed and is never going to let that happen again. And so she has really been out working on her game, and when she shows up, you can expect her to perhaps not contend, but at least not embarrass herself.
And how about Nelly Korda? I know she did not make the cut last week. Is she? What are her chances this coming week at Pebble Beach?
It all depends on her health. And look, rightfully so, that her camp is very tight-lipped about her current health status and what's hurting, what isn't, what's giving her trouble. But she has battled some injuries. She's had some back injuries. She's had some other things that have kept her out. As we all know, she underwent the procedure last year for the blood clot that kept her out for many months. So if her body is responsive, there's no better striker of the golf ball on our tour. So I think she's certainly someone to watch.
Absolutely. I have to ask you what your thoughts are on this, big story, the proposed agreement between the PGA Tour, DP World Tour, and the Saudi Public Investment Fund. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, I just don't know enough, and I don't think anybody does. If you look at the framework agreement, and I'm a reasonably bright guy. I mean, I can read, and I've read every word of it multiple times. I still don't know what it is. I mean, this new co, what is it going to do? I have no idea. I have no idea what assets are going to be in it. Is it going to do anything? I can't figure it out. And I think, quite frankly, it's intentionally vague. I think that there was a need to get the lawsuits off the table, which they have done.
Right.
There was a need to lower the temperature and to bring all parties to a table, which they have done. So I think that mechanics going forward are still yet to be ironed out. And look, anybody who says otherwise, I think, is kidding themselves. I don't think that even the people who are intimately involved know completely what this is going to mean.
Is there any talk about, that Saudi PIF approaching the LPGA?
Not to date. Golf is not good when it is fractured. It was never a good thing to have the various tours sniping at each other and the various players sniping at each other. I mean, I know it was wonderful fodder for the media, but it's just not good for the game. So we don't know what the Saudis' intentions are in the women's game, or even if they have any. At the very least, everybody is willing at this stage to sit down and listen.
Right, exactly. I know I had the commissioner on a couple of weeks ago, and she said the same thing. The Senior LPGA Championship in Indiana, Angela Stanford 1981, and I think it was it her first appearance on that Legends Tour?
It was. How about that? Well, and she had been playing. I mean, she played in New Jersey. She's played a couple of events leading in. So she had attempted to make enough LPGA starts to sharpen her game to be ready to go out there and play. So I think it's wonderful to see her win another event. It's wonderful to see her transition into this Legends category and to make that sort of a statement early on. She's a great person, just a great person.
Steve
and
Eubanks.
Really good on television, Anne. She's really good on television if you haven't tuned into the Golf Channel and seen her. When she does the on-course commentary, it's a seasoned pro out there. I mean, I've been so pleasantly surprised. You know as well as anyone, it's sometimes difficult to make that transition, you know, from player to commentating on the game. She just did it with an amazing amount of professionalism.
Well, good memories of playing golf with you, Steve Eubanks, at the Mid-Ocean Club. You have quite the game yourself. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Have a safe trip to Pebble Beach for the U.S. Women's Open. It's always a pleasure to connect with you.
And good to talk to you, as always.
Many of you in golf know Colin Burns. He was the general manager at Wingfoot in Westchester, New York for 30 years before becoming chief operating officer at the Apogee Club in Hobe Sound, Florida, with three signature courses and villas being built. And most recently, Colin received the 2023 Lifetime Achievement Award from the Monaco U.S. Celebrity Golf Cup by Prince Albert of Monaco. Congratulations, Colin.
That sounds exhausting, Anne. Good morning. How are you?
Wow. Well, you've had a very long and storied career, so I had to give you a little bit of your due here. But, man, you travel in some high circles for sure.
I have to tell you, of all the things that I did at Wingfoot in the 31 years, you know, hosting a couple of major championships, PGA Championship, all kinds of things, the event that was just held in Monaco was off the charts. Wonderful, fabulous. Great group of people, American athletes, Josh Scobie. There were some European rugby players. One of the Pussycat Dolls was there, a collection of uber-wealthy, fun people. And Prince Albert himself, Anne, was absolutely charming.
Nice. What an honor. Lifetime Achievement Award. So did you play golf with Prince Albert?
I did not. Actually, Prince Albert joined us for the formal dinner, the black tie dinner at the Hermitage. He presented the award that was co-hosted by Pascal Grisot. And Anne, you may know Pascal. He was the chairman of the 2018 Ryder Cup in Paris.
Right.
And Pascal and I met in 1995 when he was first playing in the Anderson Tournament at Wingfoot Golf Club, which he ultimately won in 1997.
I love that. So tell us, the U.S. Celebrity Golf Cup, what is it?
Well, this is started by a woman named Susan Feaster, and Susan is a resident of Monaco. She's a U.S. citizen. Her husband was a decorated Army, I believe, colonel. And after his passing, she decided that she wanted to, you know, remain active in sort of the social circle, the world of golf. She became friends through some friends with Prince Albert. He has a charity that is primarily focused on sustaining the oceanic environment of Monaco. So the two of them got together. Ultimately, Pascal Grisot got involved as the chairman of the 2018 Ryder Cup. They convinced him that it would be a good idea. And he was the first Lifetime Achievement Award winner because of the efforts he made in putting basically France on the map in terms of golf. So the idea, you know, was spawned from that. They raised money. They have multiple European sponsors. And so ultimately it's a charity that benefits the ocean surrounding Monaco and Prince Albert's charity related to that.
That's nice. So is that at a course near there? Or?
Well, actually what we did, and to make this even more of a whirlwind, is that we flew into Nice, went 2 hours into Italy, near a town called Alessio, lovely, lovely inn that we stayed at. There was 2 days of golf there, and then we hopped on a shuttle, arrived in Monaco late in the afternoon, got settled in there, had a lovely dinner at this fabulous estate that's right on the water. It was just absolutely stunning. And then the next day was the dinner and then home.
It's
set up in a Ryder Cup format, which is a lot of fun. So the Europeans versus the Americans. and ultimately the Europeans won, just like the 2018 Ryder Cup. So it was sort of sad for us, but it was a great time for everyone.
I know years ago I had the opportunity to play the Monte Carlo Golf Club. And
yes.
That was fun. And then recently we were on this golf cruise. Believe it or not, it's actually this Costa golf cruise, and you can kind of select a golf excursion if you'd like. Huh. And we played in Aix-en-Provence, but we also played Marco Simone outside of Rome, where the Ryder Cup's going to be.
Oh, how was that?
Oh, my gosh.
Really?
I loved it. It's a really fun golf course. I think as a venue for the Ryder Cup, it's going to be real exciting. Yeah.
That's great. As a matter of fact, a guy, and I'm going to blank on his last name, I apologize, the chairman of the 2023 Ryder Cup was with us as well at the dinner.
Right.
Pascal's counterpart. You know what's funny? Speaking of these fabulous European golf clubs, we visited what may be the most unique place I've ever been to, Vidabon Golf Club. And they have 30 members. Super exclusive, a fabulously designed golf course that was done by Robert Trent Jones Sr. way back in the day, and it's in the middle of what looks like a nature preserve. There's donkey on the property. There's these fabulous tortoises that they have emblazoned their logo with, and it's really what a place. And that was about, I'd say, an hour out of Nice in a town called Vidabon.
30 members?
30 members.
I love that.
I think from somebody who managed a much larger facility than that for all those years,
yeah.
the idea of 30 is just dreamy.
Well, speaking of 30, I mean, 30 years you served as GM at Wingfoot. So tell me, do you miss it, Colin?
Oh, I miss it all the time. And
I'm
it's
sure.
One of the most, I mean, you know, you've been there plenty of times. It's such a special place. And, you know, I wonder sometimes, it's still sort of new to me. By the way, I love what I'm doing at Apogee. This is a fabulous, and we can talk about that later. It's a fabulous facility. But in terms of Wingfoot, I do. I miss the people. I miss the people who I worked with, you know, guys and gals who I was with for 30 years, watched them grow, watched their children grow. Same with the members. You know, it becomes a very close relationship. And so I think I miss that most of all is the people, and I really do miss the action, you know, being at the front door like I always was for all those years, greeting everyone. And so, yeah, it is still a little bit bittersweet, but it will remain a part of me. I spent half my life there, literally.
Wow.
So it will remain very, very close to me for forever.
And you were the executive director for the 97 PGA Championships. Then they had the 2004 US-AM, the 2006 2020 US Open Championships, which I covered all those. And what highlights stand out of all those major events in your – you must have such an extensive memory bank, but what highlight stands out?
I think – I mean, besides Ryan Moore coming back from a deficit to win the 2004 U.S. Amateur, from a golf perspective, that was really special. I think from an emotional perspective, I can still close my eyes and see Phil and Amy and Bones in the locker room at Wingfoot after having lost the 2006 U.S. Open. And that remains one of those memories, both, you know, both good and bad, having gotten to know Phil during the week, but such a disastrous ending. I think that's probably one of the things that I will reflect back on a lot, because it was, we'd gotten to know each other. He was so gracious leading up to the event. He would always call before coming, went for practice rounds, just super gracious. And we spent time during the week, which really was a lot of fun. We had dinner together, and he really felt that it was his to win. And when it didn't happen, it was I think I took it very personally. I really took it to heart.
Sure. I mean, nobody can forget that. That 2006 U.S. Open, he needed a par in the 18th to win, ended up double bogeying the final hole. Used driver off the tee. The ball ended up it's painful to even go through it, right? The ball ended up in the hospitality tent. Then his next shot hit the tree. I mean, just crazy. And Jeff Ogilvie ended up with the victory. And, Phil had yet to win a U.S. Open, which would have completed a career Grand Slam for him. But, you know, reading up on all that, he later said that his play in that final round was his single greatest short game performance of his career. He struck the ball terribly, but he still had a chance to win the U.S. Open. So until that final hole, it's just crazy.
He did. And, you know, for me, as still, relatively young man at that time, I think the lesson I learned was the graciousness with which he addressed the crowd. You know, after the cameras went off and people were sort of, shutting their TVs off at home, he came out to accept the silver medal. And it was the manner in which he did that that I think, as I close my eyes, I can remember how gracious. He wasn't bitter. He actually apologized, you know, and this wasn't covered. So
I remember that, yeah. There,
you know, I mean, those of us who were there or inside sort of the rope, so to speak, saw that. And to me, it really stuck in my mind. You know, and afterwards, we sent Phil a gift. I had the members. I left something at the front desk. We had over 400 signatures, and it was beautiful gold leaf and this iconic sort of, you know, calligraphy. And I sent it to him, and it was about great sportsmanship, being a great sport in sportsmanship, and so being a gentleman. And I found this quote from the 1800s, beautifully done. So I sent it to him. I don't hear back from him, and he finally called me at home. He'd gotten my home phone number, and the conversation we had, and once again, typical Phil, he was apologizing and being very gracious, thanked us for the gift, the most lovely gift he had ever received. And it was just that whole, I think all of those events, you know, sort of, you know, have formed in my mind this both good and bad, bittersweet memory of 2006.
Sure. And I can't believe I remember this, but back in 97, I can remember exactly where that media tent was. And I was doing updates every 20 minutes back then for WFAN. And
right.
Then in 2020, the U.S. Open then, it was eerie, right? Because there were no spectators during COVID. And, you know, you're walking around and the only people there were those who were working. And then, of course, Bryson DeChambeau hitting long bombs off the tee, blasting those short irons, and he wins it. So a lot of fun memories. Not that, you know, that was a little different 2020, but boy, you've experienced it all, right?
Yeah, you know, moving, that was, you know, one of those things people have asked a lot about when I'm, you know, I'm out, whatever, doing some, you know, at a social event or a meeting of some kind, and what that was like. Well, I can remember I was sitting right where I am now, and it was March 13th, and the vendors were just about to start building the tents. And we had gone through great pains for five previous years between the security, New York State Police, the governor's office. I mean, the things that we had laid out, we thought we had such a fabulous plan. 45,000 people would be there, you know, in total. And we were on this phone call, and it was John Bodenhammer, very, very respected and dear colleague at the USGA. And it was, you know, the Brian Marsal, who was the chairman of the U.S. Open, and some others. And we said, guys, we can't do this. We can't build these tents, have them empty, kill all this turf, you know, deconstruct everything. It's just not going to happen. And that was one of those moments where we all, you know, breathed this heartfelt sigh of, it was sort of a, you know, this pang in our hearts that we had worked so hard to, you know, rejuvenate the relationship with the USGA, get another U.S. Open scheduled, and then to have it all just sort of vaporize. And then what we did was the next several months, we were on a weekly phone call, trying to figure out the Masters schedule, when they were going to schedule, the NFL schedule, because suddenly, you know, we realized we were being pushed into the fall. And it was one of those things that we worked together. And, you know, Ann, I think to me, again, one of those really fond memories was the way the USGA, Wingfoot Golf Club, the executive committee, and people outside of our particular, you know, sort of realm, worked together to make that fall happen. And while it wasn't great, you know, we had to keep resubmitting plans to the governor's office, 10,000 people. Then it became 5,000 people. Then it became basically zero. It was, you know, 450 member volunteers, people from the press, players, and the whole bubble concept. You know, no one could come into the clubhouse except players. So their managers, family, caddies, no one come in except in a handful of staff members. So from our perspective, it was kind of fun to be having breakfast next to, you know, Matt Fitzpatrick, and we saw, you know, Adam Scott every afternoon, and it was very intimate. And yes, there was certainly something eerie about it, but it was nonetheless a great U.S. Open. Bryson definitely proved that he was the better man, you know, during that period. And I still run into him from time to time. You know, we had a great homecoming with him a year later. And we flew him up from Liberty National up the Hudson in a helicopter. We had a ball. We had 500 people waiting for him, and he put on a clinic for the kids and signed every piece of paper handed to him. And it really was a great homecoming for a guy who, frankly, you know, a lot of Wingfoot members didn't know, and some of them, you know, didn't necessarily weren't thrilled about him winning, not for any other reason except they didn't know who he was.
Sure.
And when he came home, if you will, to Wingfoot that next year, It was nothing short of spectacular.
Yeah, he is a very nice guy and has gotten a bad rap in the past, but I know he means well. Anyway, Colin, we're out of time. I know you're the chief operating officer at a very exclusive new private facility called the Apogee. I want you to come back on in the very near future and tell us all about it. But congratulations on this Lifetime Achievement Award. It's just so well-deserved. And boy, we'll have you on again, Colin Burns. Thanks so much for joining us this morning on Talkin' Golf.
Dan, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Happy to welcome in a longtime favorite on the LPGA Tour, a person I've been following for a very long time, Christina Kim, veteran tour player, two-time Solheim Cup winner, 5 worldwide titles. Hey, welcome to Talkin' Golf, Christina.
And thank you so much for having me. I am super excited to be talking golf with you.
Well, it's always great to catch up with you. And you are in town to play in the KPMG Women's PGA Championship at none other than historic Baltusrol. What a historic venue, right?
Oh, absolutely. This is a tournament that is steeped in history, having hosted many men's major championships in the past. So to have the women finally at a venue of this caliber is just so, so thrilling.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's an A.W. Tillinghast Classic refurbished by Gil Hanse. And boy, they've hosted so many major championships, but this is the first women's PGA championship. So it's good to see that women are starting to play some of these more prestigious venues, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think that there's so much, women's golf has just exploded in the last several years, and golf in general as well. So, you know, having a company like KPMG, who has been associated with the LPGA Tour for a number of years, coming on as the main sponsor of the KPMG Women's PGA Championship and the PGA of America as well, taking part in this tournament and hosting this event is just, I think it's necessary. It's imperative. It is always something that has been near and dear to my heart. And I feel like just in terms of the timing of where we are in this world, it was going to be an inevitable. So I am just so thrilled to be able to say that I'm, you know, partaking in something that is, you know, historical. The first time the women are playing Baltusrol.
Now, have you played Baltusrol before, Christina?
I have. I played it many, many years ago, one time before, prior to the most recent renovations. And it is just such a spectacular, classic, quintessential Tillinghast design. And it is just absolutely breathtaking.
And what are your memories of playing it? It might have been a while ago, but what do you remember about the course?
That it's hard.
Exactly.
It's hard. It is beautiful. It is everything that you would want from a major championship venue. It's a big course. It is demanding. It never gives you an inch. You have to go out there and earn every single stroke, every single shot. And it is, that's one of the reasons why the majors are some of the most coveted events. There's no such thing as an easy major in professional golf.
Never. Not for the women, not for the men. And, you know, speaking of prestigious venues, I know the U.S. Women's Open will be at Pebble Beach this July, and they're going to Erin Hills in the future, Oakmont, back to Pinehurst number 2, the L.A. Country Club for the Women's U.S. Open in 2032. So, yeah, I mean, it is about time that, you know, you all get to play at these prestigious golf courses. And it's great to see you all at Baltusrol this week. So this is your 21st year on the LPGA Tour. You're 39 years old. What keeps you going, Christina?
Love for the game, a constant sense of curiosity, I should say. I love everything about the game of golf, whether it's the competition, whether it is learning new things about me as a golfer, you know, knowing that when I've got my back against the wall, it is make or break. And, you know, the camaraderie is a huge part of it as well. We have such an unbelievable cast of characters on the LPGA tour. We have my entire career, and just seeing the way that golf has evolved in the last, 21 years, but also in the last several years with, there's always a new crop of young, incredible women that are coming out to play professionally. The excitement of the game has never been higher, in my opinion. And I mean, I could go on and on. Like, I love playing golf. Why the hell wouldn't I want to be out here?
That's right. That's right. And you joined the LPGA back in 2003. Annika Sörenstam was dominating the LPGA tour during those years, if I remember correctly, right? And so, what are your memories about her during those early years in your professional career in the LPGA? And then I wanted to really see what your thoughts are about the women winning tournaments today, and how would you compare them to Annika in her prime?
Well, when I first got my LPGA tour card, it was a trio. It was Annika, obviously, like you had said. Sari Park was such a huge influence on golf in a global sense, and Kari Webb, like the three of them were the big three. And so it was always so fascinating and so incredible to watch the three of them battling it out. I got two wins while Annika was still competing on the LPGA tour. So those are, two really cool things that I'm very, very proud to say that I was able to do and have tournament victories in the same era as Annika Sörenstam, Sari Park, and Kari Webb. And, it's, I don't compare. I don't think it does anyone any good to sit there and compare the differences between how golf was played back then, quote unquote, versus how it's played now. It's just like all of us as individuals, the older that we get, we continually morph and evolve, and the game itself doesn't necessarily change, but the equipment changes. And I can definitely say that Annika was one of the biggest influences when it came to the need and the understanding of changes to technology, changes to nutrition, to exercise, and the athleticism required to the game of golf that is just part of the everyday staple of women's golf these days.
Right. And it's just as you get older, it's tougher and tougher to make cuts, right? But it looks like you've learned how to better deal with the ups and downs of making a living on the tour.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, it was hard back then making cuts. It's hard right now making cuts. It's the golf is as demanding as it's ever been, in terms of the scores and competition and everything else. It is, again, a game that is the game itself never changes. It's the individuals that change and the technology to the equipment. And the evolutions of golf courses themselves. Every golf course is a day older as the days go by. So for me, it has just been, again, a continual love of the game, that constant curiosity. And when you have your back against the wall, you see what you're really made of. It doesn't, I don't, I'm not a, again, I'm not a fan of comparing things. So I just sit there and say, I'm going to do my best. I'm going to try and make as many birdies as I possibly can and, see where the chips fall.
Well, I remember talking to Padraig Harrington about just changes that he made. I mean, he's been on tour for a long time. I know he's playing in some senior events as well as PGA Tour events. But I mean, what changes did you have to make physically and mentally just to be better, to basically maintain and thrive on the tour for over 20 years?
Well, I don't know if I would say that these are changes I quote unquote had to make. These were ch I have gone on, I've had a couple, I always say that I've had skinny years. I've had a couple of skinny years, and then a lot of other times I'm just a horker, and that's just who I am. I, around the pandemic, did go by way of the ketogenic lifestyle. I'm not a fan of using the word diet. I just, it's a word that I think has been just steeped in negativity. And so I have in the last few years lost, you know, I lost at the height of it, I think it was 60 pounds. And yeah, working out, and you know, I've always been very active. But for me, the reason behind going with keto is I was mentally exhausted, physically exhausted, and emotionally exhausted. And so I wanted to see if changing the foods I consumed, because clearly understanding that carbohydrates are not something that my body does process well. Pretty much everything that is a net carb is pro-inflammatory for me personally. And the understanding that, you know, the brain is a globular organ, it is not a muscle, and is comprised of 60% fat. So, you know, when you're sitting there and, you know, I'm chowing down on some walnuts, macadamia nuts, avocados, healthy fats like that, I'm in essence telling myself that I'm giving myself brain food. And so I feel like emotionally, it has been so much better for me to stay away from carbohydrates. And for me, it has been just so great to know that I am obviously nourishing my body, but I'm also feeding my brain and having that cognitive ability. You know, as we're all getting older, you know, I realize how much more mental this game is than anything else. And so I have to maintain a sense of happiness, my joy, living and choosing peace, and also just, I don't know, just finding ways to enjoy the small things and finding something every single day that gives me a sense of awe.
I love that. So, see, we get wiser as we get older. Right?
I don't know about that, but I
Well, changing topics here for a second. I know you're a human rights advocate, and I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on, you know, this story that really has dominated not only the golf news, but the sporting news in the last couple of weeks. And that's that, you know, the controversial partnership between the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, and the Saudi Public Investment Fund. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, because of everything that's taken place in the last 18 months, I don't feel like my current opinion and position has changed, which is this is not something that I personally support. But there is nuance to everything. There is more and more information. There is time to reflect on things. And two things that I've come to realize. One, well, three things really. One, the reality is everyone has a price. Sounds ugly, sounds gross. It is a reality, as is clearly evident by way of some of the actions that have been taken in the last 18 months. Secondly, you know, I feel like, while yes, in many ways the United States is at the forefront when it comes to global trends and thoughts and emotions and things like that, I think it is very, very unexpected, not ignorant in that sense, but it is sort of like quote unquote, you know, you talk to a lot of people from outside of the US that quote unquote American view that what we say is the right thing to do. You know, you talk to someone that's from Sweden, you talk to someone that is from parts of Asia, they do not have a 9/11. And so for us to sit here and assume that every other country is going to have the same viewpoint when it comes to, you know, global economies about Saudi Arabia, the way that we do, is very short-sighted of us. And thirdly, you know, the reality is you want to sit and talk about these things, look at where the British Empire was 450 years ago. They were the most reviled people on the planet. And we fast forward to present day, they're the eighth largest economy in the world. Now, does that mean that what is taking place right now is good? Personally, I do not believe so. I think that transparency and honesty would be imperative because This has nothing to do with growing the game. This is all about world dominance and no longer having a reliance on oil the way that the reliance was, 15, 20 years ago. And it's all about filling your coffers. And so if that was stated, don't think I would be able to sit here and say I would respect the decision more. I would probably just disrespect it less. But this is something that is not a choice that I had to make. So at the end of the day, my opinion means absolutely nothing because I am not involved in this.
Well, Tom Watson wrote an open letter to PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan asking for explanation and answers about the merger, calling out the hypocrisy of the PGA Tour taking Saudi money and from the country who had a role in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. I personally am glad that Tom Watson called him out. It might not affect you or me personally, this merger, it is golf and it is our country here in the United States. And it is, Saudi Arabia wanting basically to control golf in our country. So,
They don't want to control golf. They want to control the world. This is just a one tiny sector in what their overall plan is, in my opinion.
yeah, well, that's even scarier to me. So, so anyway, I'm completely opposed to this merger. And the other point is, nobody knows anything because the PGA Tour is not really telling. I don't even think they know what, a lot. So they can't even tell their constituency, the players. And that's why I think Tom Watson basically writing them in this open letter is a good thing. Who knows what answers will come out of this open letter from Tom, but we need to know something, right? I mean, I just think everybody is owed in our game, whether you're a player, whether you're a fan, whether you're the media, whether you're a volunteer, whether you're a sponsor, we basically, they should be much more transparent, the PGA Tour, and we should at least, they should clue us in on what they're trying to do, I believe.
Well, there is a large part of me that does agree with everything that you say. I have served two separate terms on the LPGA Tour's board of directors, and there, like you had said, I don't know how much the PGA Tour knows. I don't know how much the PIF knows. These are at present, this is just a way to stop the infighting. And I think that, there were a couple of options that could have been taken. Nobody was wanting to budge. Again, just because I don't agree with what the decision was by having this partnership that, again, none of I, they just said we're come to an agreement that we're going to have a partnership. I would be very, very surprised if they have anything written out. If they have an actual plan, they're just right now just trying to put out the fire. They're not at this point in time trying to figure out how are we going to go and replant the 10,000 acres of trees that have been burning because of this quote unquote war between these two organizations. Three, if you include the DP World Tour, who is also a huge part in this as well. I think that, if we went back 20 years and something similar happened where there were two parties that were in a very contentious time and place, we wouldn't know about anything until all the facts were sorted out and ironed out. We live in a world now where everyone automatically assumes that they have the right to know anything and everything at every given moment, whereas these are very complicated issues. But I do believe that what Mr. Watson had stated about the hypocrisy is very valid and very fair. But at the same time, you may want to all go and look into every single corporation that you, whether it's someone that you bank with, whether it is a rideshare app that you partake in. If you're going to sit here and say that you're not going to deal with Saudi money, you better make sure you have your own vehicle and you're not going on these rideshare apps. You better take all of your money out of your bank and stuff it under a mattress. I'm not here condoning or forgiving or anything like that. the longer that this has been going on, the more I've realized we have over 40% of US corporations have ties to money from Saudi Arabia, which is a terrifying notion that a lot of people still don't realize.
You're right. You're absolutely right. They have interest in so many American corporations. I read some of those on the show last week, based on a little bit of the research I did. But say the Saudi PIF approached the LPGA to try to invest heavily with controlling interest in the LPGA. How would you feel about that?
One, I mean, my initial thought is absolutely not. This is not something that I have any interest in being involved in. Two, again, like I said several minutes ago, everybody has a price. I don't know if my price could actually be met, because you can't really go back in time and undo atrocities. Three, at the very, very least, if what, because again, there is always that argument as well of when it comes to something, whether it's political, op opposing political thoughts and beliefs, sometimes you have to meet people where they are at the same time. And you can't just sit there and say, no, you're bad and be done with it, because there needs to be a level of grace and compassion in order for change to actually take place. And it can't just be empty words. Actions have to be taken, and people have to also have faith in those changes taking place. So, at the very least, you know, it would be one of those things where it's like, we're gonna call your bluff. You say you wanna have women be equal to men. You want to make sure that women are given enough rights, this, that, whatever. Okay, whatever you're putting into the men's game, you're going to have to give the same number to us, because we know that's not something that's going to actually happen. Society just does not allow for that. Doesn't matter what country you're in. Look at what's going on in America.
Good
You know,
points.
when it comes to just the view of society of women in as a whole, it doesn't matter what country you're in. So I think that it's a little bit short-sighted to just sit here and say that it would be strictly Saudi Arabia that if we said that to, they would balk at. Look at our own backyard. It's a sad, scary truth.
Right.
And obviously change is happening,
Well,
but
the
in
human
order for
right.
change to happen, it needs to happen slowly.
The human rights atrocities in Saudi Arabia are documented and just pathetic, right? I understand what you're saying about how women are treated in our country because there is a general lack of respect overall, stereotypical toward women. I agree with you about we do have our own issues about, equality in this country, but certainly we live in a free country here in the United States, and the horrors that we read about that are going on against women and others in Saudi Arabia are just
Beyond atrocious,
crazy.
absolutely.
My thanks to Steve Eubanks, to Colin Burns, Christina Kim, and to Mike Goodsell in production. As Queen Elizabeth II once said, it is often the small steps, not the giant leaps, that bring about the most lasting change. Have a great weekend, everybody. Be safe, be kind, and I look forward to talking with you next Saturday morning, right here on Sports Interview with Anne LaGorry.